Thanks very much, everyone. It's a great pleasure to come and talk to one of these groups again. I've been for the last few years, and some of my staff have across the state. And I'd like as well to start by acknowledging the Tunurong people, the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting, and their elders past and present. And I think it was great in the first presentation to hear about the Aboriginal involvement in the early exploration, and how some of the early explorers at least worked really with the Aboriginal communities in the areas they went through. And I'd like to talk to you today about what we do in government to protect and manage Aboriginal cultural heritage, what Aboriginal communities and traditional owner groups do themselves, and what you as historical societies and local museums might be able to do in that space, either with us or in partnership with the traditional owner groups. So I'd like to just start off by saying that it's really, as an archaeologist and someone who's worked for over 20 years all over the world in cultural heritage management and archaeology, it's been a really great pleasure in the last 6 years to be able to work with Aboriginal communities in Victoria using skills that me and my staff have developed in other areas, such as archaeological science, which is a bit of my background, doing analysis. We're doing analysis here at Bunjil's Cave in the Grampians, Garryward, looking at the pigments and where they may have been sourced from. So we do a lot of work that's led and driven by the Aboriginal community, and we facilitate that, I suppose, as the government regulator, working with the community and working also with local groups such as yourselves on material and collections and primary source material that your groups or people might have in their own possession, and understanding the kind of broader shared history of that early contact period, which I think is a really important area to work in. So what I'll try and get through in the right time frame so I don't get hooked off with a crook, is looking broadly at Aboriginal cultural heritage in Victoria, what kind of Aboriginal cultural heritage there is here, why it's important. Might, you know, not necessarily need to tell you why it's important, but want to look at different aspects of it and why we do some of the things that we do. Look a little bit at the kind of legislative and bureaucratic frameworks that we work in to protect and manage Aboriginal cultural heritage around development and land management activities. And look at the end at an example of a collaborative approach between Aboriginal Victoria, Aboriginal traditional owners, historical societies, and I suppose a local museum at Beechworth, around a collection of Aboriginal artefacts there, and how some work in collaboration with everybody was able to kind of reunite those objects with the communities where they came from in the 19th century. So just very broadly at the start, and I'll try and whip through this, we administer a piece of legislation called the Aboriginal Heritage Act. It's been in effect for almost 10 years now. We're coming up to our 10th anniversary of the legislation being in effect. There has been cultural heritage protection under law in Victoria since 1972. However, there were kind of major changes about 10 years ago that really put at the forefront Aboriginal community decision-making around heritage, taking that decision away from bureaucrats like me and archaeologists like me working for government, and putting decisions around protection and management of heritage with Aboriginal communities in regional Victoria, well, in the metropolitan region, but all over the state. So the legislation specifically recognises Aboriginal people as the primary guardians of their cultural heritage, and I suppose focuses the protection of Aboriginal cultural heritage as part of land and natural resource management and development. And the Act actually requires Aboriginal heritage to be taken into account before planning permits and other statutory authorisations, but any kind of permit or authority is given for any kind of activity that requires it. So the proponents have to consider Aboriginal heritage in advance of almost any other consideration, or simultaneously with environmental and other considerations as well. Really, what is Aboriginal heritage? Well, there are multiple legislative definitions, but it's very broad. And the legislation specifically takes into account things like archaeological, so your stone tools and other obvious things that people think of, but also social and spiritual places, which are far more complicated to identify, understand and manage, but are of arguably much higher importance and significance to manage. And it also specifically recognises significance in accordance with Aboriginal tradition, and recent changes to the legislation in August last year have introduced a specific mechanism which for the first time in Australia allows for the formal registration and protection of intangible heritage values, which is kind of based on principles from international examples through UNESCO, but there's an actual legislative framework down in Victoria for protecting and essentially giving Aboriginal communities the benefit of their intangible knowledge of things like plants for medicine and things like that, where things like intellectual property and copyright law don't work. These new laws will help, I suppose, benefit the communities who have a traditional knowledge of intangible knowledge that is a benefit to all Australians or people internationally. And we think that's an important direction to move in terms of kind of the self-determination of Aboriginal people in managing their own ideas, land and culture. So just to give you an idea about the survey of Victoria for Aboriginal cultural heritage, this is one of these kind of optical illusion kind of maps. This is in the red there on the map is the area of Victoria. It's a couple of years old now, but has been essentially effectively surveyed for Aboriginal cultural heritage. Some of those larger areas, like large national parks area, 100% of that area hasn't actually been specifically looked at, but there's been broad survey of areas of the state. And that represents about 4% of Victoria. Of that 4%, there's currently about 38,000 registered Aboriginal places in Victoria. So if you do the maths on the extrapolation, there's Aboriginal cultural heritage all over Victoria, and almost anywhere that one looks, you will come across some form of tangible Aboriginal cultural heritage, often in the form of stone tools. So the registered Aboriginal parties in Victoria, who are the organisations appointed to manage Aboriginal cultural heritage on behalf of these traditional owner groups, currently covers around 60% of the state. In the area that we're standing right now, we're in the very southern kind of part of Tunurong country, quite close to Wurundjeri country. So there's areas of the state where groups have been appointed. The areas of the state where people haven't been appointed isn't because either we don't know who the Aboriginal communities were or there weren't any Aboriginal people there. It's really an administrative phase of building up the capacity of those groups to form organisations to run essentially a statutory decision-making role in that area. And we've put a lot of resources into trying to build up the capacity of those groups in order that aspirationally 100% of the state will be covered and I'll essentially do myself out of a job. So that's really the end game with that. And this is the current picture of, I suppose, Aboriginal organisations managing cultural heritage in Victoria. There are three kind of parts of that system where in state government, Aboriginal Victoria, we administer legislation. We have a compliance and enforcement role. So if developers or land managers are doing the wrong thing and harming Aboriginal heritage, we have an ability to stop work, get search warrants and do that kind of thing. But we often try and take an educative approach and a collaborative approach rather than a big stick approach. The registered Aboriginal parties are appointed by the Aboriginal Heritage Council, who then make decisions around managing cultural heritage. And the Aboriginal Heritage Council is a body of 11 Aboriginal elders with specific expertise in heritage. They're appointed by the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, and they make decisions at a high level about appointing these registered Aboriginal parties. And they provide high-level kind of statutory advice to government, similar to what the Heritage Council of Victoria do through Heritage Victoria. Instead of being primarily architects, historians in the Heritage Council of Victoria, and I'm actually on one of their advisory committees, so we do work quite hand in glove with the Heritage Council of Victoria, but these are the different roles of the bodies that do that. As I said, we administer the legislation and we have various statutory roles. But to move on to what is Aboriginal cultural heritage and an example at the end of a really good collaborative project, I thought I'd just quickly run through some of the main types of Aboriginal heritage and where they occur in Victoria, if they're very specifically located, and to highlight as well some quotes from prominent Aboriginal elders working in the heritage space, and especially like some of the quotes about that it being part of the shared history of Australia and a collective view. Certainly the view of the Aboriginal Heritage Council is that the Aboriginal community in Victoria is relatively small in numbers, and that in order to protect and manage Aboriginal heritage effectively, it's really a joint effort between all Victorians. And it's something that through education and increasing knowledge and changing the educational system so that the history is taught much better than it was than in the past in my generation. And, you know, I went through school in the 1970s and 80s, and my parents' generation were taught a very different history, as was mentioned in the previous talk. So I think now having an 8-year-old son going through a different educational system, what he's taught at school is very much different to what I learnt in a state school 30 to 40 years ago. So the most tangible and visible Aboriginal cultural heritage, which a lot of you have probably seen either in the landscape or in collections, is stone tools. There are potentially billions of stone tools in Victoria. We've been involved in excavations or overseen kind of reporting on excavations done by consultants where up to 5,000 artefacts have come out of an area smaller than this stage in certain areas along the Corite Creek, for example. So there are areas of the state where there are such high densities of Aboriginal cultural heritage over a very long period of time that it's really incredible. And it's probably the most durable and visible and present form of Aboriginal cultural heritage in the state. And a lot more work's being done now to try and look at where the stone came from and how it was maybe traded around. So the research questions are becoming far more kind of complex and driven by the desire for Aboriginal communities to understand that better. Scarred trees or canoe trees are probably forms of cultural heritage you've all seen, particularly along rivers. Most major rivers in Victoria have these trees along them, but you also get them through the landscape. The bark was probably used for a variety of purposes. Away from rivers, it was probably used for building shelters and maybe bags for carrying things. Along the rivers, certainly, they could have been made for canoes, and there's been some really excellent projects on the Murray and on the Plenty River, not far from where I live, actually, where the Wurundjeri recently have made a canoe out of bark off a very large tree on Parks Victoria land. So it's a really nice collaboration between the land manager and the Aboriginal community. So there are thousands of these trees registered in Victoria, and if you're ever along the Wimmera River or the Murray River around kind of Gunbower Island or around Robinvale, you will see hundreds of these trees. Some of them are magnificent, they're giant. Aboriginal stone arrangements are very rare but extremely significant forms of ceremonial ground. They're most well known, I suppose, in Western Victoria. There's a very prominent one at Carisbrook. This one illustrated here. There's one near Geelong, a place called Wurdi Yuang, near the Yuyangs, which has got international prominence really with some archaeoastronomy kind of researchers looking at the astronomical alignment of the stones and looking at the Aboriginal understanding of the constellations and navigation by the stars and how these fit into the stone arrangements. And with modern mapping and computer technology where you can essentially reverse the sky back thousands of years, you can look at the alignment of the stars, which was quite different than due to the changes in rotation of the Earth. So the advances in computing and mapping technology have allowed some really fascinating research to be done, drawing on Aboriginal Dreamtime stories, which can be linked to astronomy, but not as we see it now, but as it was seen thousands of years ago in the sky. It's really amazing work. I was just talking before to George about the Budgebim landscape down at Lake Conda in Western Victoria. The federal government has recently supported the state's work, which colleagues of mine at work have been doing, on progressing the Lake Conda Budgebim landscape near Haywood in Western Victoria to World Heritage status. Some of the eel traps and lake systems here are over 6,000 years old. There's very secure dating of these from an archaeological perspective, and they're really amazing, purposive hydroengineering of watercourses for fishing and eel kind of aquaculture. It's not just catching them, it's kind of penning them and making an agriculture system that is older than the pyramids. And, you know, I did my doctorate in Egypt. I worked for many, many years in Egypt doing work there. And whilst people hold that kind of, you know, the pyramids and other things that in the Middle East and Europe up as examples, this is a amazing story that really needs to be told of sedentary villages with stone huts in Western Victoria that were doing agriculture way before the Neolithic Revolution in Europe and the Middle East. So it's a really fascinating piece of history from Aboriginal Australia that needs, I think, really international recognition so that it becomes part of the narrative of how we understand Aboriginal land use and occupation in Victoria, which is very different to Northern Australia, where people were more nomadic probably. It seems that people were far more sedentary in Southern Australia, and this is an amazing example of that, and hopefully it progresses to World Heritage status very soon. Midden sites are common along the coast and rivers. There are all around the coast of Victoria and along major rivers. There's shell middens. They're essentially the deposits of food consumption over long periods of time, but they're very indicative of Aboriginal occupation. And in the previous talk is what they came across when Hume and the expedition arrived. One of the obvious things they saw was a midden. So these, if you walk around the coastline of Victoria, the Mornington Peninsula, along the Wimmera River especially, and certainly in areas along the Murray, these are very visible. Earth features are similar to middens. They're kind of depositions of cooking and camping over long periods of time. And there's a lot of research going on in Western Victoria at the moment about the use of cooking technology and exploitation of certain plants. And because of the organic material that's in these earth features, often charcoal, shell, animal bone, we're able to use radiocarbon dating technology to date a lot of the occupation at these sites now from tiny, tiny samples, much smaller than the large kind of pieces that one used to require. So there's some really interesting research about the dates of the occupation of certain areas of Victoria going on at the moment, and really in collaboration with Aboriginal communities. Burindji Gadjin in Western Victoria near Horsham are doing collaborative work with a doctoral student at La Trobe at the moment, and they're coming up with some great results where hopefully they've got some dates coming soon, and they'll be publicising that more broadly. Sites like earthen rings are important ceremonial sites. These ones in Sunbury, one of them is an example of probably one of the worst planning decisions in relation to a significant Aboriginal place in the last 30 years. One of these five ceremonial rings is essentially on a large kind of house block wedged in between other houses built in the 1980s. It's basically become a waste ground now where people dump rubbish. There's several others in an area that are proposed for development, and actually the local council's been at VCAT with the proponent over a whole raft of issues for a number of years, and the heritage issue is one of them. So there's a greater, I suppose, knowledge and understanding now of sympathetic management in conjunction with development, but how these areas can be set aside far more appropriately and sensitively than this kind of example here. Rockwells are an interesting kind of landform in the area. The volcanic rock areas around the state, Mount Macedon, not too far from here, I suppose, in the grand scheme of things, has some quite interesting rock wells. There's also some amazing rock wells in the Warby Ranges in northeastern Victoria, which I was taken to with some Aboriginal elders in the middle of summer. There was the absolute height of summer, and because of the way they were positioned in the rocks, we went to ones where there was water that had been collected in them when it had rained however many months previously. They were covered with the original capstone that I have no idea how old it was, but potentially quite old. And the water was actually quite drinkable in the middle of summer after it must have sat there for months. And so these aren't kind of things that are there by happen chance. It would take a lot of effort to grind these out of basalt or whatever other, or granite, or whatever other kind of volcanic rock formations they're often in. And they're very carefully channeled into specific places in the landscape, often quite hidden as well. If they've got the original kind of capstone over them, it's got a little kind of gutter space underneath for the water to run into. They're very, very clever pieces of construction and design, I suppose. But I was flabbergasted by how drinkable the water was, actually, in this one in the Warby Ranges. So they're a really interesting type of cultural heritage. Greenstone axes as well, very well known in this part of the state. Mount William, a significant Wurundjeri site near Lancefield, and Mount Camel in the Tunnerong country near Heathcote, are both really significant sources of this greenstone, which is a kind of metamorphised volcanic rock, which was often used specifically for ground axes and traded all over southern Australia. And there's been some interesting research done from the 1970s onwards, really, about the distribution of those axes across southern Australia. But, yeah, not too far from here, really, I suppose, where they originated. Quarries are where stone came from. There's increasing research, as I've said, about looking at the sourcing for all sorts of Aboriginal stone, or stone that was exploited by Aboriginal people to make stone tools. Rock art sites, most common in the Grampians or Garryweed National Park, but also in northeastern Victoria around Charlton, Mount Pilot, some very significant rock art, and the area kind of around, kind of just near Myrtleford, I suppose, there's some significant rock art sites there as well. Quite different to the type of rock art in northern Australia, but still of extreme significance to the Aboriginal people of Victoria. Can't really compare it, and it's very unfair to compare it in lots of ways to rock art in northern Australia, but there are rock art sites in Victoria. And increasingly, actually, we're finding engraved rock art on rivers around Melbourne that's been covered up by things like willow trees and other European trees that were either invasive or planted there. And in recent work done by land managers like Parks Victoria and local governments, rock outcrops have been kind of cleared away, and there's very clear kind of carvings that are probably Aboriginal rock engravings along rivers like the Darabin Creek in northern metropolitan Melbourne. So that it's quite amazing when those get reported to us by often by local council kind of workers who are doing work on sites. Burials are probably the most significant, important culturally sensitive sites in Victoria. Just as a disclaimer, this isn't a picture of a burial, but like an evocative landscape. We do a lot of work with Aboriginal communities and land managers in northern Victoria, especially Murray Sunset National Park, kind of west of Mildura, between western Mildura and the South Australian border. It's just south of the same kind of landforms where Lake Mungo and Lake Victoria are, and there's burials there which are possibly of equivalent date to Lake Mungo. There's certainly Pleistocene burials there that are at least 20,000, 30,000 years old that we've had the privilege to work on. and we're doing a lot of work to re-stabilise land that was used for cattle grazing from the 19th century, and all the vegetation was kind of removed, and the dunes have eroded quite heavily, which unfortunately due to natural weather processes exposes the burials. So we do a lot of work with the traditional owners, Parks Victoria, DELP, the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning, and the catchment management authorities around protecting these places where there are really tens of thousands of year old burials there. It's an amazing landform and potentially the largest concentration of burials in Australia. So the I suppose the shared history, the post-contact Aboriginal heritage is also of significance to contemporary Aboriginal people because they can often trace a direct ancestry to the historical figures that either in things like these breastplates or to the mission sites around Victoria. So these we've been doing a bit of work with the Heritage Council of Victoria and Heritage Victoria on what we've called shared values projects to try and have consistent protection under the Heritage Act and the Aboriginal Heritage Act, and to work with the community now about how best to preserve places which are really, in lots of ways, places of trauma for the Aboriginal community. People were dispossessed and moved to the missions. They're extremely traumatic places in lots of ways, but in other ways, that's where contemporary Aboriginal community can draw a direct relation to, because, you know, there are people whose grandmothers were, you know, having their children in places like Corranderk, who have told those stories to people that are now elders in the community. So there's a direct link to those 19th century mission sites. And so the challenge then is how does one preserve those sensitively whilst recognising the trauma but understanding the significance of them? And that's something that's a challenge, I suppose, for everybody. This is an interesting piece of art in Pentridge. There was a lot of Aboriginal people ended up in Pentridge. One man, Ronald Bull, painted this mural with paint provided by prison guards. This is currently on the Heritage Register and the Aboriginal Heritage Register. It's part of the area that's proposed to be developed in Pentridge, but it's the bit of Pentridge that the developers are having trouble with. I can't understand why people are... Pentridge is a really unpleasant place to be, and I've been on several tours and several visits there and for work. It's not a surprise to me that the idea of apartments inside the cell blocks didn't really take off. But this is a really important piece of art that tells a story, really, of the life of Aboriginal people who were often put in prison for really minor crimes in the 1960s and 70s, but before that as well, and what they did to retain their culture in the prison. And it's an amazing piece of art. Spiritual places are the difficult ones to protect, and I'm going to try and just skip through here to collections and try and finish off in the next few minutes. I'm all right?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were giving me the wind-up there.
No, sorry. Oh,
I thought you did that and were winding me up. That was to you. I thought you were winding me up. So that's it. I promised I'd keep an eye on you. So I'll whip back to spiritual places then, because what I'd like to mention and how I like to explain this as a non-Aboriginal person to audience like yourselves, or if I give presentations to university students or other kind of non-Aboriginal, primarily non-Aboriginal audiences, is starting to wrap the non-Aboriginal Western kind of view of a spiritual place around a landscape, and how you might understand why a place that you can't really draw a line around with a boundary, and you can't really put your finger on why it's important to you or to the Aboriginal community, you might not really be able to understand. So these places here in Western Victoria, just as two examples, in the Budgebeam landscape at Mount Eccles, near Tower Hill in Western Victoria, and Dean Mar, which is also known as Lady Julia Percy Island off the coast of Portland, are two such places in Victoria. And these aren't the only two. there are lots. And the challenges of bureaucratic heritage manager working with developers, land managers, tourism groups, is how do you sensitively protect and manage a landscape where you're not quite sure what impacts people being there might be and how you might understand that. And the way I've explained it to some people is taking the example of the caravan park at Rosebud. And it's a place where up to five generations of families, and I know I've got friends whose families have been going there for five generations. My father used to go there as a child. I think my father stopped the tradition and we never went there, but we know people that have been going there for five generations. And if you drive past it at this time of the year, it's kind of just a bit of grass by the beach. If you go there in the summer, there's thousands of people there and they go back to the same place every year. It's quite kind of tribal in lots of ways. The family, that's this family's plot, and if you put your annex over that family's kind of bit, boy, there's trouble. But if you went there outside of that time, you would have no idea of the significance of that plot of land to that family. Or if there were places where you went maybe with your grandparents every year for a picnic at Christmas, and it's just a nice place by the river, only you or your family know why that's significant. But if somebody wanted to put a motel on it, you might be a bit peeved. So I suppose it's opening our mind to a slightly different way of conceiving of a place and a landscape that I hope, and I know that some of the Aboriginal elders I have the great pleasure to work with every day, try and come up with ways of explaining to people how to open your mind to a different way of thinking about managing and protecting places in the landscape. And these are some really lovely examples, and I think we can all look at pictures like this and say, wow, that's a really nice looking place to be. I can understand why it may have been important for hundreds of generations or thousands of generations of people in the past. So moving on to collections. So collections is an area where we have a role in registering and administering collections of Aboriginal objects, and local museums, local historical societies, and even individuals often have collections, and nobody is really looking to come and take those collections away from anybody. We're looking at ways of how to help curate, document, catalogue, and manage, and maybe jointly manage, and maybe build relationships and partnerships with the Aboriginal community from which the Aboriginal objects were originally sourced. In a way that isn't kind of bureaucratic with a big stick, or frightening in the sense that people are worried that collections that they've quite, carefully or looked after over a long period of time, how to bring those back to a joint kind of shared responsibility with the Aboriginal communities, maybe. So the picture over here is actually out of the Paris exhibition catalogue of 1878. Of Australia's exhibition stall or stand at the Paris exhibition. And these objects came from a collector called Reynold Johns, who worked all over southern Australia in the 19th century. He used his position in various government positions, including as a coroner at times, to collect objects. He also collected Aboriginal skeletal remains, which is a slightly different and more unpleasant story, but I'll kind of touch on that at the end. So there's this picture from the catalogue. All of this at the end of that ended up after a series of complicated transfers by wills and other things by museums, ended up in Beechworth in the Burke Museum. And they're displayed not quite exactly like that now, but all those objects are still there and all in the one place. So it's still a coherent collection. Johns was a prolific 19th century diarist who wrote down almost everything he did for about 50 years, and his diaries are preserved in the State Library of Victoria. So we have his diaries, we have lots of letters. He was a prolific letter writer, and he did that 19th century thing of writing a letter but keeping a copy of what he sent as well, and keeping a copy of what he got back again. There's a lot of primary source information there to work with if you've got the desire and the energy to work with it. And My wife's a 19th century historian, has a PhD in 19th century history, so I'm sympathetic to the difficulty of wading through 19th century primary sources and trying to read the handwriting. So the bureaucratic aspect of collections is that the Aboriginal Heritage Act requires objects and collections to be reported and that information placed on the register. We kind of try and actively work with local museums around that, but we try and assist where we can in those cataloguing exercises, and we can try and provide resources in order to make the record on our register as complete as possible, and maybe help out the local collections as well, who might not have the capacity or expertise to identify and catalogue certain things. Oh, there's just a little bit of information on the register. That figure probably has another 2,000 entries on it now. I didn't update that slide from last year. So the number of entries on the register keeps going up and up. And we keep all copies of reports. So there's a state register of information about all Aboriginal heritage in Victoria, which is actually a restricted register. It's not closed, but it's restricted. So one of my staff, a manager in Wangaratta, decided to work with, after a request from the Burke Museum, to work on the provenance of this collection. And we essentially launched a research project with the museum and eventually with Aboriginal communities once we worked out some more information to try and identify where as many of these objects that were sent to the exhibition were from. This is just an image of one of the pages of John's diaries. There are thousands of pages, thousands and thousands of pages. And just as a little plug for the manager of the team that I manage in Wangaratta, who looked at this, he's actually Portuguese. So English is his third language. I made it quite handy for writing to people in Paris because French is his second language. He was able to go through and transcribe these painstakingly over time, often in his own time in the evenings. And what he did was able to link specific artefacts or objects in that collection to specific places and points of collection and dates and who he got them from and where they were and how he acquired them. And by doing that painstakingly through the entire diary sequence and all the letters of exchange between Paris and Victoria at the time of the exhibition and going through these diaries, and I won't go through, but there are quite a lot of references to exact locations where these objects came from, and that's the list that was sent when the Burke Museum, when the Museum of Victoria actually at the time purchased the artefacts off the estate after he died, so we knew exactly what his estate thought they were selling to the museum as well. And by doing that, the team who did this research project were able to identify the location where the coloured-in objects came from, and were then able to match those based on, you know, the geography to the appointed registered Aboriginal parties and traditional owner groups in Victoria. So for the brown ones, we're not quite sure where they were from. The records weren't detailed enough, but the ones with a kind of orange, blue, red or pink colour there, we're able to specifically identify the point of origin of those objects, which are quite lovely kind of examples of wooden kind of shields, swords and boomerangs. So why? Why did we do this? Well, partly it was a great piece of collaborative research and exercise in historiographical and collections management, but it also meant that the Aboriginal communities now could be contacted and told that these objects of their ancestors were in Beechworth and that the Beechworth Museum would really love to work with them about how they should be curated and managed into the future. And there's been some great opportunities for elders from those communities to go to the museum, and there's now an arrangement where the museum's still going to hold them and curate them, but the community will loan them or take them back again, I suppose, for certain ceremonies and cultural events, and the museum will take on the role of kind of collection manager, because curating and looking after these objects can be a tricky business in terms of environmental kind of conditions, but really it's all done now in partnership and collaboration with the Aboriginal community, which is a really great outcome. In terms of the ancestral remains, the Aboriginal human remains as well, us and Museum Victoria and other people have been doing some fairly detailed research around ancestral remains that are currently still in the museum or other collections and identifying specifically where they were taken from. And we're able to use that information to return those remains back to the Aboriginal communities for reburial on country. So there's a strong aspect of working on the ancestral remains as well as the cultural objects as well. So it's a really rewarding and beneficial project personally and professionally for our department, for me and for my staff, and also hopefully for the Aboriginal communities and for people like yourselves who can contribute to that process by us all working together to bring together what information we have towards a shared outcome, I suppose. So thank you for that. I'll just leave our contacts up there at the end for our relevant regional manager and mine if anybody wants to talk further about that with us. But thank you all for your attention and hope you enjoy the rest of the day.